So I'll now give a talk about something or other. It is the custom which I was trained into. Whenever you give a talk, don't have much of an idea what you're going to talk about. And one of the things, one of the reasons for that is that, you know, your talk is supposed to reflect real life. And in real life, you may have plans, but life tends to go in another direction. So the whole of life is learning how to adapt to life as it changes. Just when I give a talk, I adapt to the people in front of me, adapt just to the ideas which come up. So you know that your life, I don't know what plans you had when you were very, very young. Certainly I never planned to become a monk. I had many different ideas, it just happened and here I am. Even never planned to come to Australia. Actually what happened, as a young monk I made a resolution, a determination, that I'd never ask to go anywhere. That I'd let, you know, the monks who were my seniors, people like Ajahn Chah, send me places. And so one day Ajahn Chah sent me here. And a couple of days afterwards he had a stroke, couldn't talk anymore, so that's why I got stuck here. It's true, that's what happened. Believe, and I've been here ever since, 28 years now. But never mind, I've enjoyed myself, because that's the other thing which I learnt from the life of no planning. It doesn't really matter what happens. You can always enjoy it and make something out of it. You know, that gives you a whole heap of freedom. If it goes wrong, actually, I was going to say, if it goes wrong, it never goes wrong. It just goes different, that's all. Because, you know, that sometimes we have all these expectations and demands that it has to be like this, it has to go like that. All of our expectations. And, you know, if you really did achieve all your expectations, life would not have any quality, any substance to it. The whole meaning of life is learning just how to adapt to whatever comes along. And never think that something has gone wrong. I think that's the biggest problem. It's something which we call in Buddhism, and I use this word a lot to the people over in Serpentine, to the monks and on retreats. Too many people develop what we call the fault-finding mind. And that fault-finding mind just looks at life, it looks at what happens to you, it looks at everything with this mind which is so critical, which always wants to find what's wrong with things. Now, life has gone wrong. You know, my partner, she did me wrong. Life has done me wrong. Or most people, I've done me wrong. Sometimes you ask that question about, you know, is it really wrong what you've done? Sometimes you look back, maybe you have done something bad. Last Friday, I gave a talk at the local prison up in Kana, because I used to go there to teach a long time ago. But you get so busy, and every Friday night I have to come here, or I'm overseas or something. But they invited me, look, you know, you never come to see us anymore down at the prison. Can I come? So last Friday I was in prison. I told all the other people who go to prison, make sure that if you do go and do any voluntary service in a prison, to keep a record of the hours you spend inside, to be used as credit, just in case. You never know what happens. So I've got lots of credit, so if ever I do get in front of a judge for doing something wrong, I say, I've already served many hours. You can take it off the sentence. But every time, you know, it's one of those first things that you realise, and many other people have realised the same, whenever they go inside a prison for the first time, and they come out, and I ask the monks, and I ask the other people, what was it like? You know what they always say? They say, they're the same as us. And of course, what did you expect? Just because a person, you know, is inside a prison doesn't mean they're somehow different than us. You know, that's one of the most wonderful things to see. That these people in a prison, the so-called, you know, the bottom part of society, that's how we're trying to think of them, are no different than us. They're the same. And when you see they're the same, that's when you can have respect. It's not that someone has done something wrong. They've just done something different. It's a very interesting thing to see that. Because I always thought, you know, before I used to go to visit prisons, that these were wrongdoers, these were bad people, these were criminals. But it's a powerful statement to make, and I've said it here before, there are no criminals inside the prisons of our world. There are no rapists. There are no sex offenders. There are no murderers or thieves. All there are people who have raped. There are persons who have committed sex offences, but there are no sex offenders. There are people who have stolen, but there are no thieves. There's many people who have told lies. You have told lies, but you're not a liar. If you understand that, you understand just an enormous, powerful aspect of spirituality. How you can love, even though someone has done a bad thing. How you can say, the thing they did was wrong, but you're not a wrong person. Life may have treated you badly, but life is not wrong. Someone has made a mistake. You've made a mistake, but you are not a mistaken person. Now, you put it like that, it should be obvious to you. And of course, when you do go and give a talk in a prison, these are really nice people, good mates. You can have lots of friendship with them. I did remember just last week going in there, they gave me one of the security devices in case I get attacked inside prison. And I had to keep it there, but I remember the time once I went into the prison at Casuarina. It used to be called, no, not Casuarina, sorry, the one in Canning Vale. It used to be called Canning Vale Jail a long time ago. I think it's now called Hakey or something. They changed the name, still the same place. And because it was a prison and had some very tough and mean people in there, many other visitors had been attacked. It was a men's prison, but it didn't mean because you were also a male you wouldn't get attacked and raped. And it happened many times. So at the gate when I checked in, they warned me. It's a dangerous place, and some people have been in that prison for so long, it didn't matter what they did, it's not really going to make much difference, they were going to die in that prison. So what's a, you know, they got no reason not to offend again. They can't add to their sentence. So it's a very dangerous place. And so as I checked in at the gate, they gave me what looked to all intents and purposes like a pen, like an ordinary biro pen. But they told me, this is not an ordinary pen. It's a secret security device. And they said, if you look at the ceilings, you will notice what looks like smoke detectors. They're not smoke detectors. They're our security device. If anybody tries to attack you, point the pen at one of those devices and press the top. And then the alarm will go off and we'll know exactly in the prison where you are and we will come and save you. And he said, put it in your pocket. And I looked at the person. I wear robes. I don't have pockets. You know, really, really, we cause a lot of problems for many people. You know, sometimes the reason I've got a microphone in front of me is because sometimes people, they clip these things on your, usually on your jacket or on your shirt. You know, but this thing keeps on falling off. It's a terrible thing to do. That's why sometimes you go into these radio shows or TV shows and we'll try and clip things on and say, forget it, it's going to fall off. We cause a lot of problem for a lot of people, we monks. But nevertheless, I enjoy that. And so there's no place to... So just hold it, they said, hold the pen. But they said, be careful. This is really secret. If the prisoners found out, we wouldn't be able to use this anymore, so don't tell anybody. And as soon as I went into my class, one of the people I knew there, he said, "Oh, you've got one of those security devices too." Of course they know. That's why I tell all the monks down at Serpentine and the nuns at Gitiganup, don't think that the people here in Dhammaloka don't know everything which is going on in those monasteries. There is a very strong grapevine goes on. And if there's any problems in any of these monasteries, you know about it. So the monks, they know no secrets. And it's wonderful not to have any secrets. But anyway, so when I went in there, this prisoner, and he, you know, he was actually a really good friend, because I'd known him a long time. And, you know, he's a violent man, but, you know, you get to know these guys. And he said to me, he said, "Brown, do you really think you could press that button before I jumped you and held you down?" And I said, "No. You get me first." He said, "Yeah, I would." But you know, I wasn't scared, because what he said next I knew he was going to say. He said, "But Brahm, if any of these guys behind tried that, I'd get them first. We like you, and that's your best security device." And I, you know, I always felt very safe in there, because I respected people, I knew they would respect me. Because you were kind to others, that's what they showed you back. Because they weren't prisoners. They were people who'd done crimes, but they weren't criminals. And that, because of that, I could forgive, respect, love. And there's some people who, you know, if you knew who these people were, you'd think those people, they should be thrown in jail, key thrown away, stoned, killed, whatever, because they had done some things which caused a huge amount of pain. I mean, really big pain to families, to a lot of people. But you could forgive them. You could let it go. Because you could see this bigger picture. The whole, not a criminal, but a person who's done a crime. Seeing the bigger picture in life is the whole point of coming to a place like this. Because, you know, because of the concerns of our day, we have to just make sure the dishes are washed, we have to get in the car and look after the kids and look after the finances. We're so busy sometimes, we don't have a chance to see that bigger picture. So that's why, you know, you come here to be reminded of that bigger picture. We have a bigger picture that sometimes we've got fault-finding minds and all we see is what's wrong. Because of that, we get very negative, we get very depressed, we get angry, we can't forgive, and that destroys our life. Why destroy your life? Someone's done something bad. Once, twice, three times, I don't know how many times. You know, there was one of those moments which really moved me, and I realized that, yeah, there are other people who understand what's going on in the world. Was that time when I gave, because I would go to all these conferences. During the retreat I did go over to once, visit to Sydney to give a talk at a psychology conference. And the year before I did the keynote at the World Computer Conference in Brisbane. I like interesting stuff. Anything weird, which I've never done before, yeah, let's give it a try. And so one of the conferences, the talks which, you know, many, many years ago I gave as a conference, it was in Singapore for the Institute of Mental Health. They're having their sort of 60th, 70th, 80th anniversary. And when I went in there, sort of I gave a talk, a keynote, and afterwards, you know, a few people came to say thank you, very good talk. Because, you know, even though I'm a monk, you know, you get underneath being a Buddhist, understand the real spirituality, the heart of things. You can reach people and connect with them by not following the theories, but what's really underneath it all, and why to be kind, and how you can solve those problems. And so I said that story about all these times I've been in prison, I've never seen a criminal yet. And this guy came up to me and he said, "It's really interesting what you've been saying." Because this guy, he told me, he was the head of one of the big units in this campus of mental health in Singapore, which was a schizophrenia unit. And when he told me that, I said, "How do you treat schizophrenia here?" And that's when he said this amazing sentence, which I would always remember. He said, "We don't treat schizophrenia anymore." You know, I knew what he meant straight away before he said the second sentence. The second sentence was, "We treat the other part of the patient." And actually, this guy was a Christian. I raised my hands to him and said, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. That's the Buddhist way of saying, well done, good on you, you got it. He treated the other part of the patient. They're not schizophrenic. They're a person who exhibits episodes of schizophrenia. But that doesn't make you a schizophrenic. If it does make you a schizophrenic, if you believe that, then you're stuffed. You'd exhibit those symptoms more and more and more, because that's what people see in you. And eventually that's what you see in yourself. If you're a murderer, and they call you a murderer, and you think you're a murderer, if that's what you see in yourself, that's your identity, you do it more and more and more. If you're a liar, and people call you a liar, you will lie more. Don't treat the schizophrenia. Treat the other part. Now that is understanding what the Buddha meant, that fault-finding mind just sees always the things which are wrong and mistaken. And because of that, that's why we suffer, we get angry, we get depressed, we get frustrated. The world's a terrible place. The economy's going down. What do you mean? There's so many cars on the road. There's, you know, you live in nice big houses, you've got nice clothes to wear, there's so much food around. But we can be so fault-finding and negative that sometimes people can even kill themselves, commit suicide. That's one of the other things which I've been doing during the retreat time, ghost-busting. That's another thing which I really like. There's one disciple, she was renting out her house, and the poor person inside it, I think, split up with his girlfriend and hung himself. And because that she owned the house and had to rent it, so she got a bit concerned she would never get another person to rent a house. So I went in there to make sure it was okay, first of all, to ghost bust the house. Do you believe in ghosts? You know, another thing which happened during the Rains retreat, a real ghost story. I know that sometimes people, you know, okay, you talk about Buddhism and about letting go of the fault-finding mind, but what people are really interested in is the ghost stories and the jokes. But this is actually a real ghost story which happened, because there was a poor fellow, I won't say what nationality he was, but he was actually sent to Singapore because he was getting very sick and dying. So they tried the very, very best to try and give him his very last possible throw of the dice to get him well again. But it was obvious that he wasn't going to make it. And his family, you know, were Buddhists, and they knew about me. So they gave him a few of my talks on his iPod and a book. And of course, you know, he really liked it. And so he had expressed a wish, you know, maybe I can speak to that monk, you know, before I die. But, you know, I was on retreat. They're living in sort of Australia, and they were over in Singapore. But his sister said, I'll give it a try. So she rang up and rang and rang, finally got through to me and made an appointment. And I talked to him a couple of evenings. I think he died about 2 days or 3 days later. But I managed to talk with him, and he really appreciated that a lot. And she called me the day after he died. She said, you never believe this. He died in the evening, and the following morning, he sent me an email saying thank you. An email from beyond the grave. That's really cool. I don't know how you do that. You know, but obviously, you know, they've got Wi-Fi down wherever you go to after you you die. You know, isn't that what Gmail means? Ghost mail? Anyway, that's a true story. So she got an email from beyond the grave. But anyway, so a lot of times that sort of negativity which we have, it caused that person to kill themselves. And come on. You know, that's because we can focus on the thoughts so much, become so negative. And the whole point of this being here is seeing the bigger picture. When you see the bigger picture, you can be at peace with things. Okay, so, you know, you've broke up with your girlfriend. Now, I broke up with girlfriends many times before I became a monk. No, if I see any of those girlfriends and I say, oh, thank you for dumping me or for being such a bitch that I have to, that, you know, you dump me or I dump you. If it wasn't for that, you know, I would have got stuck with you and we never become a monk. So thank you so much. I've got so much gratitude to my old girlfriends for not being sort of loving enough. Just a different way of looking at it, isn't it? So that way that, yeah, I look back upon my life, has anything gone wrong? Actually, nothing's gone wrong at all. It's just this big picture. You see all these things which happen to you in life. It's all some sort of reason, some sort of opportunity, some just little way of giving you a different experience in life, a chance to learn, to understand, especially a chance to be forgiving and to learn to make peace, to be loving when it's difficult to do so. Anyone can be peaceful when you're having a good time. Anyone can be loving when people are just nice and soft. You know, I used to have a teddy bear. You know, it's very easy to love a teddy bear because it never speaks back to you. But having a husband, having a wife or a girlfriend, that's very difficult, isn't it? Because they always keep speak back to you, or do the wrong things. They're never as compliant as a teddy bear. So I tell people, you know, for these young people, you know, don't get a boyfriend, get a teddy bear. I don't know, whatever it is you got. I mention that because apparently that somebody left a teddy bear at Jhana Grove at the retreat centre and it's still there sitting meditation in the main hall. They left it. It's a very peaceful teddy bear. Anyway, so you don't have any sort of negativity and have this great sense of positivity. And that's also, you know, one of the reasons why, you know, these people actually come up to me, you know, for counselling. I mean, tell me all these things. I mean, was it somebody came up and said they had breast cancer? Oh, very good, well done. Somebody said they lost all their money. Oh, excellent, well done. Somebody said they'd just, you know, been sentenced to 10 years in prison. Oh, very well done. And they think I'm crazy. What do you mean, you know, well done? I'm only going to say, how terrible, that's awful, what a bad thing that is that's happened to you. Now, what would that do to you if I sort of got into your negativity and approved it? And I've split up with my wife and I say, oh, that's terrible, that's awful. That just makes you feel worse. If I say, well done, marvellous, congratulations, about time. Say, oh, okay, that's okay then. No, of course, what I'm actually doing there is psychologically very powerful. What you're actually doing there is just like reassuring a person they're okay, that life is going in the right direction, that things aren't going wrong and all wrong and terribly wrong, and it's because of me that I'm wrong, I made a big mistake. Because this is the problem with human beings, they judge themselves so harshly. You judge yourself harshly, you judge others too harshly, you judge life harshly. And when you ever judge it harshly, it's gone wrong, it's terrible, you get angry. And you shout and curse and berate people you love. You can actually get angry at your kid, you know, because you think she's done something wrong. It's just kids being kids, for goodness sake. They're learning. Encourage them. You know, I learned from my father. I always bring him up because he was... He was a very great example to me. I never really understood at the time. But, you know, a few things. I remember coming home from school one afternoon, I must have been about 12 or 13, with my friends, you know, two or three friends. And we had these, I don't know if any of you kids remember these spud guns. The spud... you know, you get some potatoes, which were very cheap, and you push the end of the little gun in it. And because it was stick on the end, you had like a compression thing. And when the air built up, you know, it would send the potato bit, you know, sort of at your, you know, near your friend. So it's like, it was just like, not really the air pistols, because it didn't sort of, wasn't that sort of hard. But it was actually good fun, you know, for boys playing around. So, of course, you know, it was an afternoon off school. I invited my friends down to, you know, my father's, you know, my apartment where I lived. We had all the chairs, you know, upside down. We're having a war, having a battle. You know, kids being kids, flying. The place was a mess. And in the middle of the battle, wrecking the house, my father came in. He visited unexpectedly, and I was so scared. my goodness, I was wrecking the house. And in front of my friends, and I thought he would discipline me. But he just climbed over the chairs, I have a good time, made himself a cup of tea while we carried on with our battle. That was one awesome dad. Because he knew we used to clean up afterwards and we put everything together again. But he understood I was a kid being a kid. And I also understood one of the worst things you can do to a kid, you know, if you're a parent, is to show them up in front of their friends, in front of their peers, to embarrass them. That would have killed me. And if he'd have, you know, told me off in front of, you know, my friends and embarrassed me. It's brilliant psychologist that guy was. And of course, you know, he sort of cleaned up afterwards, just kids being kids, boys being boys, girls being girls, whatever it is. That beautiful sense of acceptance. It wasn't, you stupid kid, you'd done something wrong. I'll just clean up afterwards. Even though he was wrecking his house. You know what? Because what's more important than having a beautiful family or having a clean house? I don't know what I would like. I'd like to have a family which lived in harmony rather than a perfect house. And I've said that to all the people who've come to stay in Serpentine Monastery while I've been the boss there. I said it's more important to have a happy, harmonious monastery where all the monks, lay people, everyone is friendly, than have one which is clean, perfect, spotless, and also one which always runs like clockwork. No, sometimes our monastery, if you come to our monastery, it's a mess. But it's a happy mess, just like your house. Yeah, there are things all over the place, but people are friendly. Yeah, it's chaos sometimes, especially, I made this advertisement now in just, was it 9 days' time, we have our Katina ceremony over at Bodhinyana Monastery in Serpent. Actually, in Jhana Grove, we hold it there. Last year, a couple of thousand people comes. It's chaos. It's a mess. It's a happy mess. That's something which I learned, you know, being a monk in Asia. If it's in Sri Lanka or Thailand or Burma, you go to these monasteries, on these ceremonies, it's chaos. And sometimes, I don't know, what's happening where? I don't know, but, you know, it'll happen sometime. Now, when are we going to do the alms offering? When are we going to do this? Oh, I don't know, you know, but it's going to happen. It does. I think that's really beautiful. It's something I really like about that. You know, I never liked organized. Did you like organized religion? People say that they hate organized religion. If you hate organized religion, you've come to the right place. This is disorganized religion. But it works somehow or other. So what we're actually saying is that life is disorganized, isn't it? Yeah, we try and organize it to a certain amount. You know, how long have we been here? Dennis is in the back there. Is it 20, 25 years now in this place? We still haven't organized that dog to stop barking. Every Friday it stops barking. Is that wrong? There's nothing wrong with a dog barking. You know, that's what dogs do. They bark. That's a great insight. If the only insight you ever get from coming to a place like this is dogs bark, then you're going to be a very wise person. Dogs bark. Wives nag. Husbands are insensitive. Kids misbehave. Monks tell silly jokes. That's just the way they are. And the silly joke for today, I don't think I've told this for a while, it's a silly joke. I told a couple of people in passing. I always usually try these jokes out first of all. It was this American Indian who migrated to Perth. You know, one of these, you know, red Indians, you know, the indigenous Americans. And he migrated to Perth. And the one thing he really liked about the West was Sri Lankan tea. He liked it so much that one day he drank so much tea, he drowned in his own teepee. Don't complain, you know that's who I am. Just like dogs bark, Ajahn Brahm says silly jokes. Wives nag, husbands insensitive, kids misbehave. So what you're doing here is actually loving life and just loving yourself, for goodness sake. If the heart of spirituality is making peace, it's making peace with yourself first of all. You know, so you're in jail. So make peace with that. You may have done a crime. Cunt. Get rid of that. accept it, make peace with it, enjoy it. You've had breast cancer. Embrace it, enjoy it. It's a hard thing for me to say, but I can say that with sincerity. Because people do that, and it works. What you're doing there is you're getting this huge big picture. Whenever you think it's wrong, something is wrong, I'm wrong, life is wrong, I shouldn't have this, that's where the problem starts. There's a story. I thought this is opening the door of your heart, but the reason I'm going to say it again here is because I've been using this for the monks, people who've been meditating at Bodhinyana Monastery in Serpentine for the last 3 months. I've used this so many times to help their meditation. It's one of the classic stories. And also there's a few, in a psychology conference which I spoke at over in Sydney, co-presented with this other famous psychologist from the United States. This was one of the stories which professional psychologists and psychiatrists say that they use regularly. It's a great Buddhist story. Remember it. You can use it in so many occasions. And it's a story, a golden oldie for those of you who have been coming here for years, of the monster who came in to the emperor's palace. So if you're sitting comfortably, I will tell you the story. A long time ago, in one of those times when there was palaces, not with politicians and dictators, but real emperors. Emperors who were there because they were smart, they were wise, they were strong and very effective rulers. And it just happened that the emperor was away on some sort of business. And in his absence, a monster came in. It was a demon, ugly, frightening, terrifying. And because this monster was so frightening, all of these soldiers and guards, the people who are supposed to stop visitors coming in at the wrong time, they froze in terror, allowing this monster to walk right into the center of the palace and sit on the emperor's throne. And when that monster sat down on the emperor's chair, that was going too far. So the guards came to their senses and said, "Get out of here. You don't belong. Who do you think you are? That is our emperor's chair. You can't sit in there." And at those few unkind words and unkind deeds, that monster grew an inch bigger, more frightening, more smelly, and more offensive. And that really upset all the people in the palace. They got out their swords, they clenched their fists. "If you don't move your butt, we'll carve it out with our swords. Get out of here, quick!" But every unkind word, unkind deed, even unkind thoughts, the monster grew an inch bigger every time, more ugly, more stinky, and the language got worse. And this had been going on a long time, when eventually the emperor came back. And he came back into his palace, into his throne hall, and he saw this incredibly big, frightening monster there. He was so big, he took up most of the throne room. Huge. Talk about fat and obese. That monster, I've got nothing on that monster. The only reason I'm putting on weight, by the way, is because Buddhism is expanding. So am I. Anyway, back to the monster. This was one fat monster. And he was so ugly. I mean, really frightening. As I said in the story, even the great Steven Spielberg, with all of the resources of DreamWorks,
could not manufacture something so frightening. I've never seen Alien, but people say that's the most frightening monster in the movies. Is it? I don't know, but this monster was 100 times as frightening as the alien. It was terrifying. And as for the stench coming off this monster, it smelled so bad that the maggots crawling over his body threw up. They were sick. They vomited. And the language. The language of this monster was worse, much worse than you'd hear in Northbridge after the West Coast Eagles got beaten. It was one really sick monster. But that emperor, the reason he was the emperor was because of his great wisdom. He saw that terrifying, huge, stinky monster and understood what to do. He said the wonderful word, welcome. Welcome, monster. Thank you for coming. And at that, the monster grew an inch smaller, less ugly. The maggots stopped throwing up. And his language got better. And the people around realized their mistake. Instead of saying, get out, and getting angry, they started being kind to the monster. Welcome. Do you want something to eat? How about a pizza? Monster size. About 3 or 4 of them got on the monster's feet to give them a foot massage. Have you had a foot massage? Oh, it's so rare getting a foot massage if you're a monster. That monster, oh, just over there a bit. Oh, that's just right there. And they gave him cups of tea as well. They said, do you want a cup of tea or a cup of coffee? You know, we have Dilma from Sri Lanka. We have peppermint. It's good for your health. And there were, you know, one lump or two or honey. They were so kind to that monster that every kind act, word, or thought, the monster grew an inch smaller, less ugly, less smelly, less offensive. And soon that monster was back to the size when he first came in. They didn't stop there. They carried on with the kindness so much that soon that monster was so small that one more act of kindness and the monster vanished completely away. And that's how the monster was removed from the emperor's palace. Not with, get out of here, you don't belong. But, welcome, thank you for coming. What can I do for you? The Buddha told that story. That's a real story from the Udana in the Tripitaka. Only I added a few details, like the pizza, that wasn't in. That wasn't any. Same with the foot massage. I added that. But the essence is there. The anger. And the Buddha said to the monks, he said, we call that an anger-eating demon. And when I first read that, I thought, wow, that's a powerful message. Anger-eating demon. You give them anger. That's what they eat. That's what they grow with. That's how they become more powerful. That's what makes them bigger, stronger, and more negative. They feed off your ill will. And I've seen that so often, you know, with people I've looked at and looked with. You give the problem anger. Get out of here, you don't belong. Cancer. I can't share my throne hall with you. That anger is negativity, stress, tension, the very cause which made that disease in the first place. Disappointment. You just broke up with your partner. Get out of here, disappointment. I don't want you. It gets worse. Grief. You've lost a loved one. Get out of here. I can't stand you any longer. Those are classic
anger eating demons. Instead, you say, welcome. Thank you for coming here. All of your mistakes and thoughts and faults, the things which you're not proud of, the things which you'd be very worried about if you said, I had really good meditation during the range retreat and I can read your minds. And I said, I'm now going to read your mind. And you get very upset and afraid. You know, I was really afraid once. There was this monk who was supposed to be very powerful, could read minds. And people actually told me examples. He was doing this to other people. And I was only a very young monk at the time. He said, do you want to see this monk? And I said, no, thank you. You know, I was afraid he'd read my mind and find out what I was really thinking about. And tell other people. Do you want your mind read? Really read? And me tell you all the things you're thinking about or thought about today? All your weird fantasies and ideas? Oh, no, thank you. But what actually happened, you know, I've got the courage to see this monk, and straight away, you know, my mind was so peaceful because this monk was so kind. So kind and accepting. And even though I was a really young monk, you know, full of all defilements and just not trained at all, it felt so accepted. I felt so accepted. That was one of the first times I just wanted to sit down and never leave. I just want to stay there forever. Because it's so rare to be with a person who accepts you 100%, totally, without any criticism at all. And I knew I wasn't perfect. I knew I had lots and lots of faults. And I knew he knew that too. Because he was going to love me unconditionally anyway. That was just a wonderful feeling. There you are, a person who is going to feed all my faults, not with anger, get out, you don't belong, you're not good enough. We just, yeah, you're not perfect, that's good enough. It was a beautiful moment of spiritual peace, being with someone who would just accept you. And that's why I just wanted to be there forever. Unfortunately, there's many other people wanted to be there forever as well, so they got kicked out for the next person to come in. But I always remember that, and that was a simile for me of how to meditate and how to treat other people. Never criticize them. Never think there's something wrong. And if you don't see the wrong, you don't give anger, all my defilements were just vanishing in his presence just because I was accepted. You know, most of the things which we do which hurt other people are just reactions because, oh, we just really don't know what we're supposed to do. We just lash out. We're stressed. We're desperate. I think desperation was the word I was looking for. If we do something wrong, it's just out of desperation and stupidity. We don't really need criticism for that. We don't need ill will. We want a bit of love, peace. And then you don't do anything wrong anymore. When you look at the people in prison, you call them people who've done crimes, not criminals. It's amazing the result, you see. They should become really good people. I read this from the Dalai Lama. But I might have read it from somewhere else, but I always think it was from the Dalai Lama. He said, what you see in other people is what they show you. What you look for. If you look for another person and look for their, you know, their anger, they'll show you that. If you see a snake and look for their dangerous venom, you know, they will know that, and they might even bite you. Whenever I see a snake, I've got incredible compassion for snakes, and they're natural, not fear, but sense of compassion. So I see these beautiful snakes. I see their compassion. They show me compassion back. Never bite me. What you see in others is what they show you back. So those of you who have come with your partner today, what do you see in your partner? What you see in them is what they will show you back. What do you see in your kids? What you see in your kid is what they will show you back. That's actually how we create the world. What do you see in yourself? That's what yourself will show you back. If you see all the things which are wrong with you, all your faults, you're feeding the anger-eating demon. It will go bigger and bigger and bigger. The problem will get worse, not better. If you say, very good,
I really lost it today. I sped and got a speeding fine. You know, I got sick, whatever. Very good. Well done. And then straight away, with just that little bit of acceptance and bit of peace, the problem vanishes. Try and see, because most of these things are anger, eating demons. And just basically, you know, who you think you are. Haven't you got a peace with yourself yet? You know, this was a funny question, because I mentioned earlier that I gave a talk over Skype. You know, we're just starting to get our act together in the high tech, to Buddhist Society at Duke University, United States. And the question I was asked, because I've got a reputation there of being a funny monk. You know, they see me on the YouTube. And they said that somebody said that they knew a professional comedian. And they said, how hard it is for professional comedians always to be funny. Always have to try so hard to think of a new joke or think of a new line. And they said, it's really stressful. You know, so trying to be funny. And I said, that's the problem. You're trying too hard. Just relax. Enjoy. Have fun. Then you're funny. And that's the whole thing about life. Acceptance, making peace, be at ease with yourself. So there's no stress left at all. You are who you are. Sometimes you're funny, sometimes you're not. Sometimes, whoever you are, nothing wrong. If you're afraid of making mistakes, you make more. If you allow yourself to make mistakes, you hardly make any. That's another thing with the monastery. I tell many of you, and I've told the monks many times, tell the nuns at Dhammasara Monastery, tell the Buddhist Society, you are all allowed to make mistakes. At least, isn't it nice to have one place in the world where you can make mistakes? You're free to make mistakes and it's okay. Please, may that be your home. The place where you go to after working in the office all day, you go home. May that be a place that you are allowed to make mistakes. Then you're relaxed, you're not tense anymore, which means you don't make so many. It must be really rotten if you're in a house with a relationship, you know, it's got to that point, you're just so tense in what you say, what you do. Which means it's not a home. You tend to make more mistakes that way. So at least have a home somewhere where you're allowed to make mistakes. And if that is not the house or the apartment in which you live, may that be your inner life. You know, when you close your eyes, you know, yourself, your own inner world, the place where no one really can come in. May that be a place where you say, I am allowed to make mistakes. It's okay to bark during Ajahn Brahm's talk. It's all right to fall asleep and to snore during the meditation. Isn't that something nice? There's something very beautiful in that. It's something spiritual. It's like the heart of what this is all about in religion and spirituality. It's totally disorganized, but it's real. And it brings peace. It brings freedom. And it actually solves a problem. People are trying so hard to be good. That's why you make so many mistakes. And that's what you're told when you're young from your parents and your teachers, be good. And some of you try so hard to be good, which is that's why you're so bad. So stop trying so hard and let go and just relax some more. Don't be so tense. Your performance will increase much better. That's, you know, if you think I give talks, that's why I totally relax in front of this microphone. I'm just having fun. I enjoy myself. See whatever happens next, what comes out of my mouth. Totally unplanned, unrehearsed. I haven't got a clue what's going to happen. That's in a long time ago I thought about this. If I make big mistakes, that'd be absolutely wonderful. Then I won't be invited up here ever again. And I can have some peace and quiet in my monastery. So that's why I'm not afraid of making mistakes. I'm trying very hard to make them, but sometimes when you try hard to make a mistake, you can't make them. Why?
You can understand why. It's because you're not being tense anymore. You don't give this fault-finding mind, this anger. You don't create the demons. When you give kindness instead, acceptance, peace, all those demons disappear. When you allow yourself to make mistakes, you're giving kindness to mistakes. And the mistakes get smaller and smaller and smaller. Welcome, mistake. Thank you for coming to visit me, mistake. Thank you for coming to visit me. Disappointment. And then you find the whole sting of suffering is removed. In brief, for those of you who always want me to somehow tie this to Buddhism, because you think Buddhism is what the Buddha said in the scriptures. Yeah, that's what Buddhism is. The Buddha once said there's the two arrows, the two darts of suffering, the mental arrow and the physical arrow. The physical arrow is the world, the cancers, the disappointments, the things which we all have to face in life. The mental arrow is what you make of it. Whether you say, welcome, monster, or you say, get out of here. That's the mental arrow. And the Buddha said, that is what I teach you to remove. The physical arrow, you can't do much about. Dogs bark, wives nag, husbands come home late. Now they get sacked from work, stock market falls, whatever else is happening in life. You know that happens to each one of us sooner or later. Sicknesses, deaths. That one we can't do much about. But the other one, which is the real one, the main one, this mental error. Are you saying welcome? Or are you saying get out of here? I was reading a book during the range retreat, which is going around our monastery, called The Irreducible Mind. It was all like all these great examples, you know, like near-death experiences, hypnosis and other stuff, which is actually proving what this nature of the mind truly is. You know, written by a couple of doctors, psychologists from Virginia, who were just showing all this stupid idea that mind is somehow created by the brain. The evidence is just so strong against that. The mind is something totally irreducible and independent. And one part of that, which I always like quoting, is these near-death experiences. You know, when somebody dies, and then they go towards this light, and they go towards the, you know, beyond that light. You know, you all know about that. You may not accept it, you may believe it, but it's going to happen to you one day. But anyhow, they always say that when they go through that light, they get to this place of beautiful peace. And the thing is, they're not perfect. Ordinary people feel this great sense of peace, acceptance, love. And they come back again afterwards, because these are the people who can tell the story. Their attitude to life changes. They're not so fault-finding and critical. And all these so-called mistakes of life, mistakes of other people, they've got a big picture now, and it all fits in. It wasn't a mistake. It's something which I had to learn, something I had to go through. It was an experience which was going to enrich me. You see its purpose, the death of a son, very young. The terrible diseases which we have to go through. The frustration, being cheated, losing your money, whatever it is. From that perspective, you see, it had a meaning. It had a purpose. It was good. You talk to people who've had those experiences. These are not people who've had just beautiful lives as saints. They've experienced, just as I experienced with that great monk, you were totally loved and accepted. He taught me to totally love and accept life. Not just the nice part. All of it. Everything. Totally. What other people call disappointments. You know, I've said this. I call it shit for the mango tree. Without the shit, the mangoes would not be sweet. Without the cancers, without the divorces, without the grief, your mango, your heart,
would not be able to grow. There's a point to it. So know, love, be at peace. Not fault-finding, not negative. Feed the demon with acceptance and love, and the demons of life will vanish completely away. That's how we deal with the anger-eating demons of life. Psychologists use that, highly effective. But now you don't need to waste your money by going to psychologists. You hear it here for free. Oh, you are so lucky. So that's the talk for this evening. I don't know what the title of that talk is, but it's a bit of this, a bit of that. And hopefully you enjoyed it. Thank you for listening. Okay, I have to train you again. That's not good enough. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. That's really depressing. Come on, three big sadhus. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Doesn't that make you more happy? Obviously. So never, if you do anything, give it some oomph. Okay, now give it some oomph. You? Any announcements or something? I know there's an announcement because Carpel has been badgering me on this. There is going to be a, what's it called? A walk. There's a few of the youth group are going to walk all the way from, was it here to Serpentine?
Yeah, 9 of us, including 2 Anagarikas.
9 people. It's going to be a walk for womankind.
Walk for womankind.
Or kind women.
For both.
For both, okay, very
and,
good.
From here to Dharmasara Nuns Monastery, and we'll be doing it on the 22nd. So that's 42 Ks, and we'll try and make it there for their katina. And it's a pilgrimage for equality, a walk for womankind, to raise funds for the Nuns Monastery, to give them equal opportunity that people like me have had.
The reason behind that, as many of you know, a couple of years ago we did the first bhikkhuni ordination here. And it's not just ordaining bhikkhunis, because now the word is out, lots of bhikkhunis, actually lots of women want to have that equality. They won't actually come and ordain, but the place is getting full up now, so we're going to be building a hall. It's going to cost a huge amount of money to build that, but it's going to be the first, basically, in the world. You know, a Theravada place for women who want to live the monastic life, to live it to the full. Not under the thumb of the monks. I'm out of it, okay? So I'm not sort of controlling that at all. It's independent for women. You know what it's like in Christianity? Yeah, we've got bishops now, but still a lot of the churches, they still don't give equality. Islam is not equality at all, as far as I know. And you have to be a man to be a rabbi. But, you know, that was never the case in early Buddhism. We don't want it to be the case now. Now, I've sacrificed a lot, you know, being kicked out of the monastery where I was ordained, not ordained, where I trained. And you need to do that sacrifice. So now we're doing a big building for them. So please help out. It is actually historic. I'm not sort of mentioning that. 9 people are deciding just to bring some attention by walking from here over there, just to raise funds, raise attention for that project.
Thanks, Sarja.
And anyone on the internet who's listened to this talk, you know, it's great to be able to support this, because there's not another real place probably in the world. There's a place in the United States, support that one too, but that is quite rudimentary. So it'd be great to get this project off and running.
And, yep, our store's outside as well, so
yep.
Come and pay a visit, have a chat, and give us a few words of encouragement, as well as some donations if you have any to spare. And thanks, Arjun, and thanks, you.
Very good. So that's a big event. Okay, so let's pay respect to Buddha Dhamma Sangha, then we can go.
Arahaṃ sammā sambuddho bhagavā buddhaṃ bhagavantaṃ abhivādhemi sovākato Dhammang namasami. Supatipanno bhagavato sāvaka-saṅgho, saṅkhaṁ namāmi.